All right, let's finish up this unit. I already explained what a photosystem is. We're now on slide 11, and I gave you a general description of a photosystem, but there are actually two categories of photosystems, two types. They're basically the same, but they function a little bit differently. Anyway, they are called photosystem 2 and photosystem 1. Now you might say, why in the hell didn't he say photosystem 1 and photosystem 2? Well, this is a little bit of silliness. Photosystem 2 operates before photosystem 1, which doesn't seem to make sense, except that they were named in the order in which they were discovered by humans. We discovered photosystem 1 first and named it that. And then we later discovered photosystem 2, but it actually operates first. All right, now what we're looking at here is the light-dependent reactions, which is part one of photosynthesis. The Calvin cycle or light-independent reactions comes after this. But this is the light-dependent reactions. And structurally what we're looking at here, all of this stuff combined, makes up one functional unit of the light-dependent reactions. Everything we see here, this one functional unit, there's millions of copies of this just in one chloroplast. We're looking at just one copy, but all of them are the same, basically. Just, by the way, just to give you some perspective, we've talked already about the fact that a typical adult human is about 100 trillion cells. Well, just within one typical cell, there coincidentally are about 100 trillion atoms. It shows you how small atoms are. So that's how you can pack millions of these things into just one chloroplast of one cell. The functional unit that's shown here includes two photosystems, one of each type, but also a bunch of proteins and other particles that make up two electron transport chains. So the whole thing is photosystem 2 and photosystem 1 linked by an electron transport chain between them. And then there's a second and shorter electron transport chain after the second photosystem, which is photosystem 1. All of these work together for the light-dependent reactions. And all of the millions of other copies are doing exactly the same thing at the same time. Now, we already talked earlier about the fact that a photon comes along, and if it happens to hit in the right place, it will excite a chlorophyll, or a pigment molecule, within photosystem 2. And then by resonance energy transfer, that excitation gets moved from pigment to pigment, until eventually one of them will excite the special pair of chlorophylls that are in the reaction center complex of photosystem 2. And remember I said that when that happens, it gets so excited that it totally loses its electron to the reaction center's complex's primary electron acceptor. And as we talked about in lab, that means that the primary electron acceptor is becoming reduced in the process by receiving that electron. All right, now, the same thing, meanwhile, is happening in photosystem 1. A different photon happens to strike one of the pigment molecules in photosystem 1, the second photosystem, and same thing happens, resonance energy transfer moves the excitation until it hits the special pair that's in photosystem 1, and it also loses its electron. Now, when either of these special pairs of chlorophyll in the reaction center complexes, one for each photosystem, loses its electron, that is a very unstable situation. Meaning that chlorophyll in the reaction center complex that lost its electron really wants to have an electron back to make it stable. And I say an electron rather than the electron because it doesn't have to be the electron that just got lost. As long as it's an electron, all of which are the same as each other, then it can be replaced. All right? Well, let's look at this second photosystem, photosystem one. When its reaction center complex chlorophyll loses its electron, an electron that replaces it is one that comes from photosystem two, because the primary electron acceptor that received it, that electron, passes that electron down the electron transport chain that links the two photosystems. So at the end of the chain, you have an electron replacing the one in photosystem one that got lost when it got excited. Is that all clear? Now compare what's happening here to what you've already learned in the previous chapter about electron transport in cellular respiration. What is the purpose of cellular respiration's electron transport chains?
To establish a gradient.
That's right. The transport of electrons from member to member of the chain means that the electron gradually loses energy, and that energy that isn't lost as heat goes into powering the members of the electron transport chain that are also operating as pumps, proton pumps. And that establishes, as you said, a proton gradient. And why is that useful? What is the reason in cellular respiration that the proton gradient needs to be established?
For a potential energy source to drive.
No, it's a result of electron transport chain. The electron transport chain pumps the protons and establishes the gradient. And then what does the cell, the mitochondrion in cellular respiration, do with that gradient?
Makes ATP.
Right. When the protons that have been pumped come back through the membrane by diffusing, the only place they're allowed to do that is through ATP synthase molecules, which then spin, and that phosphorylates ADP into ATP. So the payoff is production of ATP.
So the gradient has to go through the mitochondrion inside the chloroplast to do the ATP synthase, because it's not in the chloroplast?
No, it's in both, is what this is the point I'm making. I wanted you to compare electron transport in the one you've already learned, which is cellular respiration. Well, this electron transport chain between the two photosystems in a chloroplast is not identical in terms of the members of the chain. Chemically, it's not identical to the one that's used in the mitochondrion for cellular respiration, but it functionally works exactly the same. So even though that all the details aren't shown here, the end result of the electron going from photosystem 2 to photosystem 1 is pumping of protons and then diffusion of protons to spin ATP synthase molecules to make ATP. That's why you have ATP being produced here at this first electron transport chain. All right, so that's how photosystem 1, the second photosystem, gets an electron back after it loses that one to the primary electron acceptor. Well, photosystem 2, the first one, has also lost an electron, but it doesn't get replenished with an electron trickling from an electron transport chain, because there's no transport chain before photosystem 2. So it's a different source of electrons for this. And the source is water. Okay, now think of the overall summary of photosynthesis, inputs and outputs. The inputs are carbon dioxide and water. You have to give plants water. Well, one of the reasons is that water for photosynthesis is used as a source of hydrogens. Okay? Water gets split in the chloroplast. And when you split a water molecule, you have two hydrogens and an oxygen, right? Well, one oxygen atom is why they wrote it as one half of O2, because when you then split another water, you'll get another oxygen atom, which will combine into an oxygen molecule. That's why photosynthesis produces O2 as a byproduct. Oxygen comes out because that's what's left when you take the hydrogens off of water. But it's the plant isn't trying to make oxygen, it's trying to get hydrogen. Compare this, by the way, and think about the reciprocity between the two processes. In the complete oxidation of glucose, the reciprocal process, we take in oxygen, or the cell does, not just us, any aerobic respirer does. We take in oxygen, and then we remove hydrogens from fuel, which eventually get put onto that oxygen to make water, right? It's exactly the reverse in the reciprocal process. In photosynthesis, water is the starting point. We take hydrogen off of water and put it onto a carbon skeleton to make fuel. But when you take hydrogens off of water, which is what's happening here, think about it once again, just like in the previous chapter, think about it in terms of subatomic particles. When you take off two hydrogens, what you have are two electrons and two protons. Well, one of those two electrons is what replaces the one that's lost in photosystem two. And then when this happens again, in the next instant, you have another electron to replace it as well. So as long as you keep having water available, you can keep operating the light-dependent reactions, and as long as you have photons, of course, light. All right. So in a sense, even though this is kind of different from the replacement in photosystem one, even photosystem one's electron comes from water. It just first trickles down through the electron transport chain before it finally gets there. Everyone clear on that? Okay, and then the hydrogen ions, which are the protons from the hydrogens, those are there still. We've talked about the electrons, but the hydrogen ions are there. They get pumped by the chain, just like in cellular respiration. And eventually they will make their way to the carbon skeleton, which is part of this part two of photosynthesis when the sugar is actually produced. Okay, now the only thing I haven't mentioned here is that the electron that is removed from photosystem two and goes to its primary electron acceptor then gets passed down this shorter second electron transport chain, and that second chain does not produce any ATP. Instead, the electrons coming down that chain, along with protons from solution that came from water, get added to NADP plus, an empty taxi, to reduce it into NADPH. All right? Therefore, the overall accomplishment of the light-dependent reactions is to transform light energy into chemical energy in two forms. ATP, phosphorylated ADP, in other words, and reduced coenzyme NADPH. So think back to the summary slide that we started with a couple lectures ago, where we said that the Calvin cycle, which we're getting to next, that which is where the sugar actually gets produced, that's the payoff of photosynthesis, that Calvin cycle, or light-independent reactions, requires energy in both of these forms, ATP and NADPH. Well, the light-dependent reactions makes both of these forms that the second part requires. What I have just described now, as described, is called non-cyclic electron flow, because the electrons move in one direction from beginning to end, not in a cycle. All right? But we wouldn't bother calling something non-cyclic electron flow if there were no such thing as cyclic electron flow, which we'll get to in a minute. First, though, I want to show you the cartoon in 12, which is the same information. It just puts it into cartoon form to maybe you'll appreciate it. So the photon is kind of like the huge hammer that excites the electron, moves it uphill. That's photosystem 2. And then when this woman rolls it down the ramp, that's electron transport. It's losing a little bit of energy at a time. That allows for the pumping of protons
which produces ATP, kind of like moving the mill here. But it's really the gradient of protons being leading to diffusion of protons back through the membrane that makes the ATP by spinning the ATP synthase molecules. And then a separate photon excites the electron again, and it goes down a shorter chain to reduce NADP plus into NADPH, NH plus. Well, speaking of cyclic electron flow, which I just mentioned, we're looking at it here in slide 13. So this looks very similar to two slides ago, slide 11, except notice that some of it is a little bit dimmed out. Remember that all of these structures, the two photosystems plus all the electron transport chain members, collectively make up a functional unit for the light-dependent reactions. Well, and there are millions of copies of them. But any individual functional unit can operate at any given time in one of two ways, either for non-cyclic electron flow or cyclic electron flow. Here we're seeing cyclic electron flow. So there, what I'm trying to say is that there aren't some functional units that are dedicated to one process and some functional units dedicated to the other. Every unit is the same, and it can go back and forth between the two modes of operation, either cyclic or non-cyclic electron flow. It's called cyclic electron flow, which we're what we're looking at, because when the primary electron acceptor of photosystem 1 receives its electron, it does not send it down the second chain. Instead, that electron goes back for another trip through the first chain. So that's the cyclic aspect of it. All right. Why do this? Well, I mean, if this happens, first of all, notice that since the electron is not going down the second chain, then no NADPH is produced. If it goes back through the first chain, then that means more ATP gets produced. So cyclic electron flow produces ATP only as an energy-carrying molecule and doesn't also produce NADPH. Non-cyclic electron flow produces both ATP and NADPH. Well, I've told you already that the Calvin cycle needs both. So why would you have cyclic electron flow, which produces only one? The answer is that the Calvin cycle does need both types of energy-carrying molecules, but not in a ratio of 1:1. The Calvin cycle needs more ATP than it needs NADPH. So if all that the plant or photosynthesizing organism does is run non-cyclic electron flow, it will make just as much NADPH as ATP, which you can look at as either of two ways. You can say that's making too much NADPH or not enough ATP, because it's not making them in the right ratio. Therefore, any given functional unit will switch between cyclic and non-cyclic electron flow to ensure that the Calvin cycle gets the correct ratio of NADPH to ATP. And you might be saying, well, how does it know which mode to run? It's actually automatic. Think of these taxis, these NADP taxis. It's a different company, like I said, because of this phosphate it has, but it operates the same as the taxis in cellular respiration. There's a lot of them, a lot of individual NADP taxis, but it's a finite number. Just like in a city, there's a lot of taxis, but the fleet is only so big. Any individual taxi is either busy carrying passengers or it's empty. Okay? Since the Calvin cycle does not need as much NADPH as ATP, then that means it's going to be using up the ATP as it's produced, but it's not going to use up all the NADPH. Which means eventually all of the available NADP taxis will already be full. And therefore none of them will be able to come and pick up an additional electron in this second chain. If that's true, then this chain automatically shuts down, and the only possibility for the electron is to go around another trip in through the first chain, which is cyclic electron flow. And that will produce more ATP, which is appropriate, right? Until you get up to as much ATP as to match the demand for NADPH, the Calvin cycle will use them both, and eventually that will empty some NADPH taxis back into NADP plus form, and they will automatically go back and pick up passengers from the second chain, so it will automatically go back to non-cyclic electron flow. Just back and forth, and that way the Calvin cycle receives exactly the right ratio of the two energy-carrying molecules. Is that all clear? Okay, good. Let's go to 14. Well, we've already been comparing electron transport as it occurs in cellular respiration versus photosynthesis. Here we have a slide dedicated to that comparison. This box in the bottom can represent either electron transport as it occurs in a mitochondrion or in a chloroplast. Notice you have a light gray and a dark gray chamber. Well, if this is considered to be a mitochondrion, then the light gray would be the matrix. That's where the protons get pumped from. The membrane would be the inner mitochondrial membrane. They get pumped through that, and then they accumulate in the intermembrane space. That's where there's a high concentration. That's why there's a gradient. Those protons then would want to diffuse back through the membrane into the matrix, but since they're charged, they can't get directly through the phospholipid bilayer, and the only place they can get through are ATP synthase molecules that spin in response to phosphorylate ADP into ATP. That's cellular respiration. The same thing is happening in the chloroplast, except if we consider this to be a chloroplast, then the names are different for the structures. The chamber that the protons get pumped from in a chloroplast is the stroma. That's outside of the thylakoids, but inside the inner membrane. And they get pumped through the thylakoid membrane into the thylakoid space, inside the little coin-like sacs. That's where the concentration of protons is high as a result of the pumping. And they therefore want to diffuse back out into the stroma through the thylakoid membrane. And once again, the only place they can do that is through ATP synthase molecules, so ATP gets produced here as well.
The stroma is outside of the grain?
Yeah, a granum is just one stack of thylakoids. There are several grana. They're all made of one membrane, and the insides of them are all continuous, so it's all one compartment, the thylakoid space. And the stroma is all the fluid that's outside of the thylakoids, but inside the inner membrane. This white space between the two is a separate chamber. That's the intermembrane space. Okay, 15 shows you an anatomical summary of the light-dependent reactions. So we're only showing you one functional unit and one ATP synthase, but there are millions of copies of each of these just within one chloroplast. And this is just very close up, because this is just one thylakoid of one chloroplast within one cell. The cell would be much bigger than the building. We have photosystem 2 and photosystem 1 embedded in the thylakoid membrane, along with an electron transport chain that links the two photosystems, and then an electron transport chain after photosystem 1. Photons excite the pigments. They transfer their excitation to the reaction center complex, which lose their electrons to the primary electron acceptors. Well, photosystem 2 passes its electron through the chain that links it to photosystem 1. That replaces the electron for photosystem 1. Electrons from water replace the one from photosystem 2. And then the electrons from photosystem 1 travel down the shorter chain, don't produce any ATP, but produce reduced coenzyme NADPH. The operation of the first chain produces a proton gradient, and those protons escape back through the membrane into the stroma through ATP synthase molecules. So in addition to NADPH, you're also producing ATP. Exactly the two energy-carrying molecules that the second part of photosynthesis, the light-independent reactions or Calvin cycle, require. Well, speaking of witches, let's look at the Calvin cycle, slide 16. As the name indicates, it's a cycle just like the citric acid cycle is, which means it's a biochemical pathway that instead of just going to an end, the end wraps back out around to the beginning. So there is a start-finish line at the top of this circle, just like there was for the citric acid cycle. And that's where inorganic carbon comes into the Calvin cycle. Remember that the Calvin cycle is the part of photosynthesis that involves carbon fixation, which is such a big deal since only producers can do that, right? Carbon dioxide, remember, even though it contains carbon, is considered to be inorganic. And so you have inorganic carbon source coming in at the top of the Calvin cycle. That is carbon fixation, because when it comes in, it gets the carbon of CO2 gets added on to the carbon skeleton of the last intermediate in the cycle that comes up to the start-finish line. And that last intermediate is called ribulose bisphosphate, which is just represented by 5 gray dots to show you that it's a 5-carbon compound. Okay, ribulose bisphosphate. Bis means 2. There's 2 phosphates on it as well. Ribulose bisphosphate is a 5-carbon compound, and you add another carbon from CO2 that's coming in to produce a 6-carbon compound called a short-lived intermediate. They didn't even name it here because it doesn't even last a tiny fraction of a second. It immediately gets broken into 3-carbon chunks. But anyway, that is carbon fixation, because the carbon that was part of CO2 is now part of a carbon skeleton with carbon-hydrogen bonds in it. That's an organic compound. We can see that the Calvin cycle overall has 3 major phases to it, the first of which is carbon fixation that I was just describing. Phase 2 is called reduction. Well, remember, reduction doesn't happen in isolation. If you have reduction, something else is being oxidized. In cellular respiration, by the way, to compare it again, the reductions that occurred were to reduce the taxes, the coenzymes, right? To invest them with energy, and the fuel became oxidized. Well, this is the reciprocal reaction. So the reduction occurs to the intermediates in the Calvin cycle. The fuel gets reduced, and the taxes get oxidized because they're supplying the electrons. That's why you have NADPH, which was one of the products, energy-carrying products of the light-dependent reactions, being reoxidized into NADP+, because it's going to reduce the fuel that's in the Calvin cycle. All right? And then the third phase is regeneration of the CO2 acceptor. Well, the CO2 acceptor is the thing that receives CO2 at the top, right? But specifically, it is ribulose bisphosphate. In other words, in order for this to continue, you have to convert all these intermediates eventually into ribulose bisphosphate so it can receive some more CO2 and keep it going. Now, energetically speaking, notice what's going on here. This whole Calvin cycle requires ATP here, ATP here, and NADPH here. But look at the numbers. 6 ATP here, 3 ATP here for 9 total ATP. But only 6 NADPH. This is what I meant when I said that the light-dependent reactions need to switch back and forth between cyclic and non-cyclic flow, because it's not a 1-to-1 ratio of NADP to ATP. It's a 3-to-2 ratio.
Does ATP and NADPH come from the first cycle?
Right, from the light-dependent reactions. And the hydrogens that are being carried by the taxi here came from water. And those hydrogens are being added to the intermediates in the cycle, which, look at the bottom, every once in a while will spit out sugar in the form of G3P. That's the final direct product of photosynthesis. We kind of pretended in the summary that the final product is glucose, which is a 6-carbon compound. But really, what the Calvin cycle directly produces is not a 6-carbon compound, it's a 3-carbon compound called G3P, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. That's why it has 3 carbons here. But once you have that, you already have an organic compound, and therefore you can just combine it with others and rearrange things to make not only glucose, but just about everything else as well. So photosynthesis is not just about feeding the organism by creating fuel, organic fuel. Those organic compounds that are produced can also be used as structural elements. I mean, you can add nitrogen and make amino acids. Once you have it in organic form, you can do anything, basically. Whereas we consumers can make anything we want out of the organic compounds, but we have to get those from other organisms. We can't make our own organic compounds. Okay, now, at the start-finish line, you see there's, as you already expect at this point, there's a separate enzyme used at every step. We're not looking at that detail. But there's one special enzyme right up here at the start-finish line, so to speak, and that is called Rubisco, which is an acronym, but I prefer to spell it with more than one capital letter. I prefer to spell it capital R. That sucks. Capital R U, capital B I S, capital C, capital O. It's still an acronym, but this way it shows you what it really stands for, which is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. So let me write this out. Much easier to say Rubisco, of course, but when you write out the full name, you can see from the ASE ending that it's an enzyme. Okay, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase is not ribulose bisphosphate. Ribulose bisphosphate is the 5-carbon compound that serves as a substrate to the enzyme called ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase, or Rubisco. You can see that it's an enzyme from the ASE, but also notice there's 2 ASE endings. In other words, not only is this Rubisco an enzyme, but it's 2 enzymes in one. It can be used either as a carboxylase or as an oxygenase. Okay, now I want you to once again think back to the previous chapter. Remember the first step of cellular respiration? Do you remember what that is? Of cellular respiration. No, glycolysis is not part of cellular respiration. Part one of cellular respiration. No, that's part two. What did you say? That's another name for the citric acid. That's part two. The first part is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate.
You had something good.
Yeah, because cellular respiration starts where glycolysis leaves off, which is pyruvate. Right? The reason I'm mentioning it is that remember that it's a decarboxylation, removal of a carboxyl group, which is a carbon and 2 oxygens. So decarboxylation is removal of CO2. And in cellular respiration, when you remove that from pyruvate, you have the acetyl group left over, and that's what gets driven by coenzyme A into the citric acid cycle. Okay? Well, here we don't have decarboxylation. We have carboxylation happening, adding CO2 to a carbon skeleton rather than removing it. That's exactly what's happening here at the start-finish line with the help of the enzyme called Rubisco, because Rubisco is a carboxylase, something that can carboxylate something else. And that is what should happen. If you want to anthropomorphize plants, we would say that the plant wants Rubisco to operate as a carboxylase, and only as a carboxylase, because the whole purpose of this is carbon fixation. And unless you bring a CO2 as an inorganic carbon source into the top, in other words, unless you carboxylate, you're not fixing carbon. The problem here is that Rubisco can also operate as an oxygenase, meaning that instead of adding CO2 to ribulose bisphosphate, it can add oxygen instead. Well, that's bad for a couple reasons. One is that that doesn't add any carbon. You're not fixing any carbon, and therefore the Calvin cycle is not operating for its goal, which is to produce sugar. All right, that's bad enough. But it's even worse because if you add oxygen instead of CO2 to ribulose bisphosphate, you produce something that's not supposed to be there in the cycle. And that will not only disrupt the cycle, but it will take time and energy for the plant or other organism to modify that wrong substance back into the right substance so that you can get the cycle to work properly again. Okay, so it's a waste of energy, plus it doesn't result in any sugar production. Those are both bad. And if that happens, if oxygen comes in instead of CO2, then that is called photorespiration. Photorespiration is a wasteful process. And no photosynthetic organism really wants it to happen. But it does happen because the air contains both CO2 and oxygen. And to make matters worse, Rubisco, which can operate either way, actually works better as an oxygenase. It has a higher affinity for oxygen than it does for CO2. So if they are both present, which they are in the air, then more often than not, oxygen wins out and the plant has to go through all this wasteful process of getting things back to normal so that it can continue making sugar. So it's a continuous problem in most or typical plants, which are called C3 plants. Photorespiration is just a reality of life for them. It makes photosynthesis less efficient. Of course, there's so many photons available from sunlight that it still is supports life on Earth, but it would be more efficient if you didn't have this problem of photorespiration. And some plants have evolved a way around this problem. Go ahead.
What did you say about C3?
C3 is the name of the group of plants that have this problem all the time. And there's just nothing they can do about it. No, they just have to spend energy solving the problem continuously so they can get back to normal operation. So they don't make as much sugar for each amount of energy coming in as light as they could. Well, in 17 we can see one of the groups of plants that have evolved mechanisms to solve the problem of photorespiration. And this group is called C4 plants. Now, think back to the slide that showed you the structure of a leaf, which I compared to a sandwich, where the pieces of bread are the epidermal cells, and then you have a layer inside of what were called mesophyll cells. In a C3 plant, that's all you really have in the sandwich is the mesophyll cells, which is where photosynthesis is occurring, always with this problem of photorespiration. C4 plants have evolved this anatomy. There are mesophyll cells in C4 plant as well, but notice that they are arranged superficially, meaning toward the surface of the leaf, and therefore closer to the air. A second kind of cell is also found in them, though, called bundle sheath cells, and notice that those are arranged deeper in the interior, and therefore away from the air. Okay, now, the way to accomplish the way to solve the problem of photorespiration is to separate two processes that occur together in a C3 plant, a normal plant. Those two processes are carbon fixation and the Calvin cycle. They occur in the same place and are in the same cycle in a normal C3 plant, as we've already described. But here in a C4 plant, these two processes are separated from each other. Carbon fixation and Calvin cycle happen separately. And the way C4 plants have done this separation evolutionarily is to separate the two processes spatially, meaning have them happen in different spaces, namely different cells. So you have the mesophyll cell here on the right. This is the one that is close to the air surface because it's superficially situated. Well, the air is where the oxygen is, and the oxygen is the problem, right? That's causing the photorespiration. It's no problem in a C4 plant, though, to have the mesophyll cell close to the air, because the mesophyll cell operates a separate cycle that you see here that does not involve Rubisco. Instead, it involves an enzyme called PEP carboxylase, phosphoenolpyruvate carboxylase. You don't have to know what PEP stands for, but that's what it is. Notice that it's called carboxylase, so it operates as a carboxylase and therefore can add CO2 to something else, just like Rubisco can, but PEP carboxylase does not also operate as an oxygenase. So even though there is oxygen here, it doesn't interfere. And this is where the carbon fixation takes place, in the mesophyll cell of a C4 plant. So the CO2 comes in, that's carbon fixation, and that produces an intermediate. You see here oxaloacetate is a 4-carbon compound, that's why they're called C4 plants. But then this intermediate gets transformed into other intermediates that then get delivered through plasmodesmata to the deeper cell called a bundle sheath cell, and the CO2 that was part of these intermediates in this first cycle then gets released again in this deeper cell and picked up by the Calvin cycle in that second cell, which uses Rubisco. But since this is such a deep cell, Rubisco isn't interfered as much with oxygen because oxygen isn't in the depth of the leaf nearly as much as it is near the air. So the rest of the Calvin cycle operates just the same as any other. It produces sugar. But this is a lot more efficient because you have a lot less photorespiration occurring in a C4 plant. That's one way of solving the problem. Slide 18 shows you a C4 plant again. This is the same thing we just looked at. And it separates the processes of carbon fixation and Calvin cycle spatially. It does them in different spaces, different cells. A different group of plants, though, have evolved another way of separating the processes. Those are called CAM plants. This is another acronym. CAM stands for crassulation acid metabolism. And that seems like a weird word, crassulation. That is, crassulations just happen to be the type of plants in which humans first discovered this process. They're not the only ones that can do it, but any others that can do it are still called CAM plants because they work just like crassulations. But anyway, crassulation acid metabolism, or CAM plants, have solved the problem by separating the two processes temporally rather than spatially, meaning that one of the processes, carbon fixation, occurs during one part of the day, one time, and then the Calvin cycle occurs at a different time of day. So you can see here, instead of having separate cells, you have night and day listed. In CAM plants, unlike most other plants, remember the stomata, the little openings in the leaves? You have to have those open in order for any gas to come in, including the CO2 that you need. But in a CAM plant, those stomata are shut down during the day, sealing off gas exchange. By the way, this has an added benefit because these CAN plants tend to grow in places that are really hot, and therefore there's a lot more potential to lose a lot of water by evaporation, which can be deadly. So it's just an added benefit that when they close down their stomata during the day, they're not losing nearly as much water because that's the hottest part of the day when you evaporate more. But the reason they're doing it in terms of photosynthesis is, let me just start over and say they open it at night. That's why that's at the top, okay? They're open at night. The CO2, therefore, can get in at night. And the CO2 gets fixed into organic acids. That's why it's called crassulation acid metabolism. The organic acids are holding, temporarily storing, the carbon that came from CO2. They're storing the CO2 as organic acids. And so organic acids accumulate at night. And then the next morning, the stomata close so that no oxygen can get in. And the organic acids that have stored the CO2 overnight start being broken down to release the CO2 to the Calvin cycle, which is not going to be interfered with oxygen because they've closed off the stomata during the day. And therefore, the Calvin cycle can operate as normal and produce sugar. And so this is another way of tackling the problem. It's just a temporal separation, or a separation in time rather than a spatial separation. Any questions on those? Okay, well, that brings us to the final slide. 19 is just a summary slide. So I've already given you all this information, and slide 19 looks essentially identical to a summary slide we looked at earlier in the slideshow, but now you know the particulars. Keep in mind that photosynthesis as an overall process, if it's occurring in a eukaryote, occurs entirely within a chloroplast, unlike the complete oxidation of glucose, which is partly in the cytosol and partly in the mitochondrion. Well, in photosynthesis, it's entirely within the specialized organelle, which is the chloroplast. And there are two parts to photosynthesis, which are the light-dependent reactions and the light-independent reactions, or Calvin cycle. The light-independent reactions, the second part, is what actually accomplishes the goal of photosynthesis, which is to produce organic compounds in the form of sugar, G3P specifically, out of an inorganic source of carbon, CO2. Okay. Doing that, assembling a large complex molecule out of small, simple molecules, of course, is endergonic and anabolic. Right? Therefore, you can't have the Calvin cycle operate by itself. It has to be supplied with energy to do it. But this is another place where I want you to compare the two reciprocal processes. A plant or any other photosynthetic organism is not capable of directly using the energy source, which is sunlight, to drive the carbon fixation part, to drive the Calvin cycle. Compare that to complete oxidation of glucose. Cells need energy for all kinds of endergonic processes. That's why we burn fuels, right? But cells aren't capable of using the energy directly released from burning fuels to drive those endergonic processes. Instead, we need an energetic middleman, which is ATP. So we produce ATP using the energy that's released from fuels, and then we use ATP to power the endergonic processes. Similarly, plants don't directly use light energy to drive the endergonic process occurring in the light independent reactions to produce the sugar. It needs an energetic middleman, and that's what part one is all about. The light dependent reactions capture light energy that gets absorbed as photons by pigments and transforms that energy into two chemical forms, NADPH, which includes hydrogen from water, and ATP, the two energetic requirements to run the light independent reactions. Well, using those energy sources in the light independent reactions, spends them, right? So they get transformed into their lower energy counterparts. ATP gets transformed into ADP and inorganic phosphate. NADPH, the reduced form, gets oxidized into NADP+. Those then drive back to the light-dependent reactions to get recharged over and over. So as long as you have water and light, all of this will continue to happen and the plant will make more and more sugar. Not only for fuel, but as for raw materials for all the things that cells use in the organism. And thankfully, there's enough for us to live as well when we eat the plants, or eat something that eats plants, or eat something that eats something that eats plants, and so on. That is the unit. Anyone have any questions before I turn off the recorder?
You said that canned pork is more efficient for photosynthesis. I remember reading on the sketch book, it said canned grape, not canned grape.
C3?
C3 plants are much more common.
They are. Most plants are C3 plants. And so these ones that have evolved these mechanisms, C4 and CAM, are the minority, but they do the better job.
Like, wouldn't they be outcompete the
C4? It's reasonable to think that, and it might be happening gradually. But despite having the problem of photorespiration, there is so much light that gets transformed into sugar that it is a disadvantage compared to these two that do it better, just not enough to make them go extinct, apparently. And it might be that eventually they're outcompeted by these other mechanisms, and effectively all plants might eventually be either CAM or C4. That's a good question, though. Yeah.
So I don't understand the difference between C3 and CAM pumps, because they both, the two processes are the same for both, the two, right?
Yes, but in a CAM plant, they still separate the processes. They just separate them in time. In a C3 plant, they don't separate the processes at all. They're happening at the same time, same place. C4 happens in two different spaces. CAM happens in two different times.
Did those develop after a result from this temperature?
Well, that can be a strong selection pressure.
Okay.
Now, any evolution starts just as random mutation. So it's not that an environment causes mutation. It's just that if a mutation happens to randomly happen, that makes it beneficial in that environment, then that environment is going to be a strong selection pressure to favor that particular mutation.
So the CAM put the pineapple in a more temperate climate, hotter.
That's right.
As opposed to, so that makes sense. Okay.
That's right.
I think most cactuses around here are CAM, aren't they?
Yes. Yes.
Too many damn CAMs.
So,
what's that?
So, like, millions of years ago when the environment was more oxygen-rich and a higher temperature, could we reasonably assume that CAM plants were probably more popular?
Well, I don't think they've ever been more popular than they are now, but I actually don't know time-wise when they came on the scene.
Prevalent before?
Maybe the amount of oxygen kind of...
Well...
And they inhaled the oxygen...
That's right. Mushrooms, though, and all fungi in general, don't lump those together with plants like a lot of people do. I know, I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying people do, because they grow out of the ground. But actually, fungi are much more similar to animals than they are to plants, and they're not photosynthetic. They do the same thing as we do. They secrete enzymes out of their body to break down the food that they then absorb. We just do that in a tube that our body surrounds, but they do it, you know, we're still secreting enzymes out of our body into our digestive tract. We just happen to eat the stuff so we can run around while doing the absorbing, where they have to stay in place while they're doing the absorbing. Yeah, that's a big difference between fungi and humans, or I mean animals in general. Remember to bring a Scantron.